Hello and welcome to episode 15 of Orthodoxy, Autocracy and Nationality, Tsardom to Empire, Russia's Westernization from the reign of Peter the Great to Catherine the Great. Now, what do I mean by Tsardom to Empire? Because I'm sure some perceptive members of the audience can already see that Tsardom to Empire essentially means the same thing. A czar is a Caesar, which is an equivalent rank to an emperor. So we're going from empire to empire, which doesn't really on the surface make any sense. However, it does make sense in the sense that we're talking about the attempt, or the rather the attempt of various Russian rulers, czars to emperors, to imitate European customs, institutions, ideas, dress, etc. And how sincerely these ideas sort of seeped into wider Russian society and became part of the governing maxims, or sort of ideological bedrock of what it means to be Russia. Now, when I was mulling over how to organize this stream as part of the series, I thought at first of dividing Peter the Great and Catherine the Great and the period around the 18th century into two parts. But I thought thematically, it made much more sense to link these two periods together and understand them as a whole. So then we can go into the 19th century and understand this idea of Russia's split identity, the ideological schism between Russia as Western, looking towards the West, modernizing, liberal, whatever that means, or more Slavophile, looking to the East, more focused on traditions, orthodoxy, etc. The legacies of Peter the Great juxtaposed to that of Ivan the Terrible. And something I also want to illustrate during this lecture is how, while the two czars may seem very different, Ivan Grozny, Ivan the Terrible, and Peter the Great, there is actually a huge amount which unites them, both in their approach, but also in the challenges which they faced during their respective reigns. So within that context, and discussing this idea of transformation of the Muscovite Tsardom to the Empire of all the Russias, we'll get started with the context surrounding this period. Now, something which has often gone, well, almost completely unmentioned, are these sort of various precedents for reform, which had preceded Peter the Great, because it didn't start with Peter the Great. Just to outline that we're talking about the period from 1676 onwards, and in the year 1676 is the death of Tsar Alexis. Russia has just faced off a major Cossack revolt, the Stenka Razin Cossack revolt. It has just overseen a major campaign in Poland, decimating its economy and reducing its international stature quite considerably, and pushing the border boundaries of Russia towards the city of Kiev and the left bank Ukraine, or the eastern sort of side of the River Dnieper. Combined with that, we also have the major religious schism between those adhering to the reform of the Patriarch Nikon and the Raskol schism, the old believers who pertain to the older rules established by Macarius and during the reign of Tsar Ivan the Terrible. But I've titled this particular slide, A House Divided. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, when Tsar Alexis died in 1676, he left essentially two families, one from his first wife, Maria Miloslavskaya, and his second wife, Natalia Naryshkina. And at first, it seemed that who would later become Peter the Great had no chance whatsoever of becoming Tsar, because Alex had a elder, Peter had an elder half-brother, who became Tsar Fyodor III, the forgotten progressive Tsar, mainly forgotten because he suffered a premature death as a result of a debilitating hereditary form of scurvy, which seems to have affected the early Romanovs. But nevertheless, Fyodor was responsible for establishing Russia's first institute of higher learning, the Slavic, Greek, and Latin Academy. And this is partly as a result of the recent annexation of many parts of Ruthenia or Ukraine. And there was subsequently a considerable influence of the Kiev school. And he was unusual, Tsar Fyodor, in the fact that he was positioned under the tutelage of Simeon Poniatowski, who was from the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. And so he was fluent in Polish, and he was also fluent in Latin, which was quite unusual for a Russian Tsar educating the Orthodox tradition at that time. And it's through him that he pulls off one of the most famous Russian reforms, which again is often credited to Peter the Great, which is the abolition of the Menichespor, or the old table of ranks. And this was through the influence and the advice of the great reformer, Vasily Golitsyn, who will play a major role in this period leading up to Peter the Great's formal reign. And during this time, Vasily Golitsyn spent a large amount of his time leading armies against the Crimean Tatars and Ottoman Turks. But as I mentioned, Fyodor died very early. He became Tsar at the age of 15 and died at the age of 20, precipitating a succession crisis called the Streltsy Uprising. Ivan, Fyodor's younger brother, and 6 years Peter's senior, so he would have been about 15 or 16 by this time, by right should have become Tsar, though in contrast to his younger brother, who would later become Peter the Great, Ivan was considered unfit as both physically and mentally infirm. In the confusion following Fyodor's premature death, the Narishkin family, the second family of Tsar Alexis, took advantage of the confusion to persuade the then patriarch to proclaim the 10-year-old Peter as the Tsar. And unwilling to see her side of the family sidelined, we have one very ambitious daughter who you can see on the right in this rather terrifying image by Repin, which was painted in the 19th century, Sofia Alexeyevna. She was the elder sister of Ivan V. And she wasn't actually the eldest sister. There were older sisters, including Martha and I believe Evdokia. Both of them had entered into convents, and she hadn't as of yet entered into a monastic lifestyle. And she was considered the most intellectually formidable out of all of the children of Alexis. And she, believing that she should be in command rather than either her half-brother or her mentally incompetent younger brother, started spreading rumors among the Streltsy, the garrison guard in and around the Kremlin and Moscow, that the Narishkin family had murdered her brother Ivan. Now let's take a step back a bit and examine who the Streltsy were. They were established during the reign of Ivan IV, Ivan the Terrible, as an elite force, and they're famed both for their use of muskets and their rather large pole axes. And they served the Tsar for life, in whose capacity they served as the Kremlin guards and a Moscow police and firefighter force. Though as the office of Streltsy was hereditary, their effectiveness as a military task force quickly declined. They had remained loyal to the Tsar during the Skenska Razin 10 years before, but by 1681, they had essentially become a Praetorian Guard with a high social and military elite status, an attachment, ironically, to the now heretical beliefs of the Old Believers, in addition to a hostility to innovations in the army that would challenge their status. So again, as part of this ongoing series of orthodoxy, autocracy, and nationality, I hope you see the similarities between the Streltsys and their contemporaneous institution, the Janissaries, a Yanisheri, the Ottoman Empire. By the death of Tsar Fyodor III, there were roughly around 20,000 Streltsy in the capital of Moscow. The rumor of Ivan's murder spread quickly throughout the Streltsy, who turned against their officers and stormed the Kremlin twice, killing Peter's two uncles, Kirill and Ivan, in Peter's presence. He was only 10 at this time. Mobs joined the Streltsy in an orgy of mayhem and looting in the capital called the May Revolution of 1682. Natalia Narishkin and Patriarch Joachim showed Ivan IV to the Streltsy, here in the image on the left here, to confirm that he was indeed alive and the rumors were indeed false. And as a result of this, a compromise was effected. Russia was placed in the unprecedented situation of having two czars, Ivan and Peter, though, of course, as you know, as Russia was modeled very much on the Byzantine model and, of course, the imperial model of Rome, the idea of having a czar and his colleague was, or rather a Caesar and his colleague in Augustus and the Julius Caesar was an established tradition. And that is the tradition they hearken back to establish this co-rule between the two czars, the two families. Nevertheless, Sophia had successfully exploited the Streltsy to eliminate her chief opponents in the Narishkin clan and position herself as the chief of the regency for Ivan, for Ivan was the nominal senior Tsar as his mother was dead. Nevertheless, Sophia had been forced to compromise despite her military coup. Ivan was universally considered unfit, and the joint Tsar solution was proffered to prevent Sophia ruling in her brother's name for the rest of his life with the full expectation that the nominal junior Peter would come to rule in his own right upon a certain age. So there was always an element of fragility baked into Sophia's attempt at essentially usurping the rule of her brother and her half-brother. Nevertheless, Sophia would rule Russia for the next 7 years. She had already gained experience as the advisor to her brother Fyodor and employed his chief official, Vasily Golitsyn, to share in the burdens of administration. Speculation arose as to whether their relationship was romantic, although, again, this was speculated at the time and has been speculated since. There's been no evidence to substantiate this other than the familiarity of their of tone of correspondence. And again, this has to be mentioned in the fact that this is before the Petrian reforms, the reforms of Peter, and women were still secluded in this Russian system of the Telim, where women occupied a floor of the house or a floor of the Kremlin palace and were not supposed to be seen in the presence of male dignitaries, etc., who weren't part of their immediate family. No longer content to mere dupes in a palace revolution, the Streltsy at first presented a major threat to Sophia, who they'd just given power, and they tried to compel Sophia to bring back various aspects of the old believer worship, which I indicated earlier was a particular idiosyncrasy of the Streltsy movement. Essentially, they wanted, when Sophia rejected this, to install their own puppet regent in power and to reverse the raskol, or the schism, which had been ushered in during the reign of Alexis. Nevertheless, Sophia was able to crush the rebellion with the backing of some loyal boyars, notably Shaklovitiy, in a moment of Russian history immortalized as the Kovan Shishina by the opera writer, sorry, not librettist, but rather opera composer, Modest Mazovsky, in the 19th century, who also composed Boris Godunov. The regency now secure, Sophia continued in the reforming vein of her brother, patronizing his Slavonic Greek Latin Academy, while through Galitzin she engineered the Eternal Peace, which ended Russia's 100 years war with Poland and stabilized the border with Poland until the partitions from 1772 until 1795. Jan Sobieski, the famous king of Poland who defeated the forces of Kara Mustafa Pasha during the attack on Vienna in 1683, Sobieski made territorial concessions to the Russians, including the important cities of Smolensk and Chernigov, in return for Russia joining Poland's side in the Great Turkish War. Galitzin also secured the Treaty of Nechinsk with the Qing Dynasty of China, which established Russia's border with China until the 1860s. Up until now, Peter had been removed from politics. During official functions of state, Sophia, though now styling herself as Russia's de facto ruler with the title of Gosyuda, or Great Sovereign, was still confined by the Terim system. Instead, she would instruct the young Tsar through a small hatch behind the joint throne she had commissioned for Peter to share with his brother Ivan. Throughout his adolescence, Peter did not seem to care that Sophia and Galitzin ruled in his name. Instead, he developed a fascination with many things considered foreign to Muscovite traditions, such as sailing and shipbuilding. During the Regency, Moscow's German Quarter, or rather the Nemtsky Quarter, which is a term referring to all Western foreigners, was established during the reign of Vasily. So it had been there for roughly about 200 years up until this point. And by 1700 or so, it made up around 20,000 people, so 10% of Russia's, or Moscow's, sorry, 200,000 population. Peter's proximity to the city's German and Dutch population left an indelible mark on the young Tsar, who would meet the Scot Patrick Gordon with the Swiss Franz Lefort and cultivate a relationship with the Westphalian daughter of a trader, Anna Mons, shortly after his marriage to the conservative, or rather his arranged marriage to Evdokia, which would prove completely disastrous. Alongside his passion for sailing, the young Tsar was renowned for his war games with his toy regiments, the Preobrazhensky and Semyonovsky regiments, and these would often prove to be lethal. He would have many fatalities as a result of these war games, quote unquote. As Peter had now attained his majority and married Sophia, Sophia's own political authority was evaporating. Sophia had hoped that by marrying Ivan off quickly, and by Ivan producing a male heir, the Miloslavskaya clan of which she was a member would remain in power. Yet, as a male heir had been unforthcoming, all of this seemed to be unraveling. Continued Crimean raids into the southern part of Russia per the Great Turkish War had dented her popularity. Her desperation reached a peak when her entourage suggested that she take power in her own name as Tsarina with the help of the Streltsy once again, per the advice of Shaklovitiy. Instead, the Streltsy deserted en masse to Peter. Sophia surrendered to Peter and was forced into an exile at a convent. Galitzin was exiled and Shaklovitiy was executed, And again, Jacques Levity was executed specifically because he tried to induce Sophia to use the Streltsy to, if not depose Peter, then potentially murder him. Peter continued to rule as Khozar to Ivan V, and despite the overthrow of Sophia, his mother Natalia Naryshkin assumed the mantle of government until 1694. But from 1694, Peter the Great assumes direct power for himself. And I have here a map of essentially what Russia looked like from, it says circa 1700, but there's very little differentiation in the borders between about 1686 and 1700. And Peter's great initiative, again, inspired by his fascination with foreigners and his own maritime obsession, was to establish Russia as a maritime power. Now, as you can see on this map, despite the fact that Russia is the largest country in the world at this time, it is essentially landlocked. It has a small opening in the just north of Sakhalin in the east, a small opening through Astrakhan into the Caspian Sea. No access to the Black Sea, no access to the Baltic Sea, and access to the White Sea, which is frozen over most of the year, which again makes it almost impossible to trade. Now, again, linking this back to Ivan the Terrible, Ivan the Terrible was faced with the same situation, and he attempted to charter an English company operating out of Arkhangelsk in the northeast of Russia, east of Karelia. Nevertheless, this was part of the contributing reasons for his wanting to acquire Livonia, which is modern-day Latvia and Estonia, and expand the port of Ivangorod, which, interestingly enough, is sort of like proto-St. Petersburg. So for all intents and purposes, despite being the largest country in the world, Peter the Great wanted Russia to become a major maritime power, but it was essentially landlocked. Sophia's own war, per the Polish Eternal Peace Agreement against the Turks, had been an embarrassing failure for Sophia. But Peter here sensed an opportunity to acquire for Russia a maritime outlet through Azov on the Don. By 1696, and after two campaigns, Peter the Great took Azov and would later found the first Russian naval base at Taganrog, though Azov would only be held by the Russians until Peter was forced to cede it back to the Ottomans in 1711. After his initial success against the Ottomans, Peter hoped to broaden the Holy League in furtherance of Russia's goals through the remarkable strategy of his grand embassy, whereby the Tsar would abandon Russia and travel to the various courts of Europe incognito. Nominally, Franz Lefort was leading the embassy, but Peter directed the mission, the absurdity of Peter being able to travel discreetly when he stood at 6'8". And Peter's one of these remarkable specimens. We have an image here. It doesn't really demonstrate it, but it does sort of hint at it, this image on the left, is that Peter the Great stood at 6'8". Nevertheless, his body was seen as overly bulky, whilst his limbs and his head were considered very small. So he certainly left an indelible impression on anyone who was there to see him. And the idea that he could actually physically travel incognito, when the rumor, of course, of the Tsar of Russia approaching with his massive entourage of drinking Russians was all the more ludicrous. He traveled to Brandenburg, Prussia first, where he concluded an alliance with the elector, later king of Prussia, king in Prussia, Frederick I. And then he went to see William III of the Netherlands and England in Utrecht. And it is in the Netherlands where he trained personally as a Dutch master shipbuilder before accepting William's invitation to visit England, where he learned how to manufacture naval artillery. On his way back to Russia, he went to Vienna to try and prevent an Austrian truce with the Ottomans to no avail. It soon became apparent that the inevitable war over the Spanish succession against France was of greater interest to the European powers than continuing the conflict over the Ottomans. Confronted with the diplomatic reality, Peter went to Leipzig and concluded an alliance with the King of Poland and the Elector of Saxony, Augustus the Strong, against Sweden. Other than the diplomatic consequence of the embassy, Peter had used this as an opportunity to enlist foreign experts, manufacturers, etc., scientists, artists, into the service of the Russian Tsar. In the absence of, in his absence, many of the Streltsy had been in secret contact with the former Regent Sophia, disgruntled over a combination of factors, namely horror at Peter the Great's embassy and the rumours of foreign military experts returning with him to possibly lead reforms in the army. And this was combined with the fact that the Streltsy had endured many privations following the Azov campaign. A group of Streltsy elected members to form a military government to depose Peter and restore Sophia. Ivan V had recently died. therefore ending this possibility of using him as a puppet czar. Peter rushed back from his embassy and, under the command of Patrick Gordon, the Scot, easily crushed the rebellion. Peter was ruthless in his crushing of his revolt. Thousands of Streltsy were executed and tortured. Often they were tortured to, again, false confessions, the names of other potential conspirators. And Peter himself took part in the beheadings. He took part in the executions. After this, the Streltsy were disbanded, and Sophia was exiled again to a further monastery, completely out of the remit of Moscow. Upon returning to Russia, Peter imposed clothing reforms on the boyars, who were to give up the traditional Russian dress and adopt European, invariably French clothing, including the infamous beard tax, which incurred widespread resistance to the sacred traditions in the Russian Orthodox Church pertaining to the growing of beards. Coupled to with his first wave of westernizing reforms, Peter introduced the Julian calendar. All of a sudden, the year 7207, dated from the year of creation, became the year of our Lord Jesus Christ, 1700. That same year, Peter the Great declared war on the seemingly inexperienced Charles XII of Sweden, in concert with Denmark, Norway, and Poland, Lithuania, for control of Ingria. And just looking back at this map, in previous maps of Russia, we have seen that the Russians did control this area around Ingria and around the Neva, the Ingerland. And this area was ceded to Sweden as part of the ongoing stratagems of the Romanov dynasty to create peace. It was under Tsar Michael that this area was given up because Russia was simply in no position to exert any sort of external power and was more focused with the idea of attaining a long-lasting peace and stabilizing the dynasty. But now that Russia is in a better position under Peter the Great, and Peter the Great is focused on his maritime zeal of attaining a port on the Baltic Sea, which will be open more often than not compared to the White Sea ports, like such as Arkhangelsk, Peter essentially used this opportunity to rally an alliance against the Swedes, who had already made themselves universally unpopular through their expansionistic antics over the last 50 years, including launching campaigns against Denmark, Norway, and the Scania, and Poland, Lithuania during the deluge. Peter, first of all, attacked the city of Narva, which is just in eastern Estonia, east of Rival and Tallinn, only to be decisively defeated at the Battle of Narva, where Charles XII personally, despite being outnumbered 3-1, exploited a freak snowstorm to immediately attack the Russians, the snowstorm obscuring the size of the forces, the Swedish forces, and how tiny the Swedish army was. And he was able to inflict a casualty rate of 10 casualties on the Russians per one Swede. Convinced of the incompetence of the Russian army, Charles essentially abandoned the idea of invading Russia and attacked Poland and Lithuania, believing it to be the greater of the threats, while Peter urgently reformed the Russian army, utilizing the breathing space Charles XII had now afforded to him, even resorting to measures like recalling the Streltsy. In 1703, Peter the Great took the Ingermanland and founded the new city of St. Petersburg on the banks of the Neva. To hurry the construction of the city and monopolize Russian talent for it, all construction of stone edifices outside of St. Petersburg was banned. He himself moved out of the Kremlin to his new project, living in a log cabin with his mistress and later wife, Marta Slavronskaya. Her own origins are contentious. It is possible that she exploited her beauty to become first a Swedish camp follower, then a mistress of a Swedish officer, before becoming the mistress of Russian marshal Shermitev, and then entered into the household of Peter the Great's great confidant, Prince Alexander Menshikov. That year, 1703, she converted to Orthodoxy and took the name Catherine. By 1706, Poland and Lithuania was defeated, and Charles had installed his own ally on the throne. Charles XII invaded Russia in 1708. This invasion of Russia coincided with yet another major Cossack rebellion against Peter, the Bulavin Revolt around Astrakhan and the mouth of the Volga in southern Russia. At Golovichin, Charles defeated Peter the Great again, to which Peter responded by implementing a policy of scorched earth between the Swedish army and Moscow, while Peter himself moved to cut off Charles' military reinforcements and avoid a direct military engagement, essentially employing Fabian tactics. Unable to reach Moscow, Charles XII moved to invade Ukraine, only to meet Peter's army at the climactic Battle of Poltava in 1709. Outnumbering Charles 2-1, Peter broke the Swedish army, potentially killing about half of the Swedish battle participants, losses which Charles could not replace. Charles then fled to the Ottoman court in Constantinople, while Stanislaw, his ally in Poland, was deposed, and thus Poland re-entered the war on Russia's side. After a failed campaign to capture Charles XII in the Ottoman Empire, the Ottoman Sultan expelled Charles and returned for Peter, ceding the important city of Azov. In the Baltic, things fared far better for the Russians, who overran Livonia and Finland, while the Imperial Russian Navy gained their first victory at Ganjut. The war continued until Charles was shot by a sniper in Norway in 1718. In the ensuing Treaty of Nieland that ended the 20-year war, the Great Northern War, Russia gained territory in the Baltic states and Finland, Finnish Karelia, the territories which Ivan IV had failed to acquire during the Great Northern War. Akin to the Livonian Wars, the Great Northern Wars and its aftermath was a time of substantial reform in Russia aimed at the furtherance of imperial autocracy. Until 1711, the Council of Boyars, or Duma, had assisted the Tsar's rule in Russia. Increasingly, the rights of the Duma had been infringed with the abolition of the Menichesvo, and many tentative reforms aimed at the amelioration of the serf, beginning with Golitsyn. The Boyars' Duma, meanwhile, had been growing progressively throughout the 17th century. In 1711, the Tsar reversed this trend by abolishing it in favour of a 10-man governing senate dependent on the Tsar and guided by a procurator general known as the Sovereign's Eye. The Zemsky Sobor, or Russia's Estates General, had been convened to ratify Regent Sophia's eternal peace with Poland, and it was never again summoned for the duration of Imperial Russia's existence. As addendums to the governing senate, which functioned as Russia's supreme judicial, executive, and legislative body, under Tsar Peter, these institutions replaced the old state departments with new colleges for foreign affairs, finance, war, etc. And they were invariably staffed at first with non-Russians, upon which Peter could rely. Non-Russians, of course, being seemingly entirely dependent on the Tsar, having skills which Peter the Great admired, and having no constituency to fall back on. And Peter the Great would have to suffer the loss of popularity, essentially of alienating the traditional role of the Russian nobility. To replace the Menichesvo, Peter created the table of ranks determined not by birth, but by service to the Tsar, Sluzba. The system had 14 grades, and every aristocrat began at the bottom as a collegiate junker, again modelling this after the Prussian system. And from this rank of collegiate junker, the noble worked his way up the system. Top ranks were attainable only via direct promotion from the Tsar. Meanwhile, Peter instituted a Western style of liberal education in the natural sciences for the sons of the nobility, preparing them for lives as officers of state. Now they were obliged to serve either 25 years in military or civilian service. Members of the non-nobility who entered into the Sluzba, the service of the Tsar, automatically attained nobility upon being positioned on the table of ranks. In a way to curry favour from the nobility against this, and in order to fund the construction of St. Petersburg, Peter abolished the land tax in favour of a poll tax, which applied to peasants and serfs. Military conscription was established, forming the basis of a professional army based on the Prussian model, though it quickly became the largest standing army in Europe. The Streltsy were finally abolished. In 1721, Peter modified his title of Tsar to that of Father of the Nation, Emperor of all the Russias. Why this was done, this formal adoption of Russia as an empire rather than Tsardom, was partly to enter into the European system of royalty, where the title of emperor held a precedence over other European monarchs of lesser rank, and this rank was acknowledged by some, such as Poland and Prussia, and resented by others, such as Charles VI, the Holy Roman Emperor, as the title of emperor implied universality. Peter rejected a compromise whereby he would adopt the formal title of Emperor of the East. Nevertheless, the title of Tsar always held an imperial universal dignity, though little recognized outside of Russia, and so the title never fell into disuse. And for those who may be confused from my use thereafter, I'm going to be using the titles of emperor and Tsar interchangeably. Nevertheless, there were broader implications in this move away from the Byzantine customs of Russia as the Third Rome. The capital had now changed from Holy Moscow, so did the coronation ritual. But Peter reserved major reforms for the Russian Orthodox Church. The Tsar and Church had worked in tandem since the inception of the office and the coronation of Ivan IV, Ivan Grozny, Ivan Terrible, by Metropolitan Makarios, and by the 1580s, Moscow had attained a patriarch and in the reign of Alexis, Nikon had presided over reforms of the church that brought it into line with Greek Orthodoxy, creating the Raskol, the Old Believer Schism. Theodore had begun a process of Ukrainianization of the Russian clergy, relying on clergymen from Poland, Lithuania, and now recently annexed Left Bank Ukraine, a process that was intensified by Peter. Subtly, bishops such as Nikon and Philolet, the father of the first Romanov Tsar Michael, had promoted the independence of the Russian church and the spiritual and institutional prerogatives of the patriarch. Yet now Russian prelates had effectively become marginalized within the church, while Peter, having already brought in measures to undermine the clergy, such as the beard tax, was accused of having not only foreign but Protestant Lutheran sympathies. The church was not spared Peter's zealous administrative reforms. When Patriarch Adrian died in 1700, the former Uniate Church, and the Uniate Church is essentially the Catholic means of bringing the vast number of Polish-Lithuanian Orthodox subjects into union with the Catholic Church and with the Pope. Essentially, these are the Greek Rite Catholics, Orthodox in liturgy, but in union with the Catholic Church. Essentially, the reforms were led by a Uniate Church member and Ukrainian, Yavrosky, who was given the rank not of patriarch after Adrian died, but of custodian of the church. After an imposed interregnum of some 20 years, Peter imposed his collegiate reforms on the church, following the advice of another Ukrainian theologian from the school of Kiev, Prokopovich, which established a national church, somewhat inspired by the church or the kirch in the Scotland. This would be led by an ecclesiastical council under the Tsar as the unambiguous supreme spiritual authority. As with the governing senate, Peter established a governing synod of 10 men with his own procurator general, dependent on the emperor. The clergy system of appointments came to mirror the table of ranks. Perhaps one of his most significant reforms was that on monastic recruits, whereafter only men over 50 could become monks in an effort to prevent what Peter believed was a waste of Russian talent dedicated solely to God rather than the Tsar. The final significant reform was that of the succession, Peter having now established the fundamental laws of the Russian Empire. The Tsar's only son, Alexei, was brought up by his mother Evdokia and estranged from his father. The Tsar was considered, or rather the Tsarevich, was considered competent and intelligent. They expressed little interest in his father's modernizing zeal and became the focus of many groups hostile to Peter. Together with his mistress, Afrosina, Alexei hosted a rival court while spurning his Brunswicker wife chosen by Peter. The hostility between the two only increased when Peter exiled Alexei's mother to a monastery in order to marry Catherine. Peter at many times compelled his son to follow the mantras laid down by him in Western learning, in the hope that Alexei would continue in his father's vein of reform. After the birth of his son Peter, Alexei opted to renounce the throne in favor of his son. When Peter summoned Alexei to join him on campaign, Alexei fled to the court of the Austrian emperor in Vienna. The Tsar, through the intercession of Count Peter Tolstoy, convinced the Tsarevich to return to what had essentially become the solution to an international scandal. And on the note of Count, so we have the abolition of the boyars, essentially. And Peter modelled the new Russian aristocracy post the Table of Ranks on a system imitating the titles we find in Germany. So there are essentially three titles which mattered: Baron, Count, and Prince. And there were, you know, minor differentiations between the ancient nobility, the hereditary nobility, but it was essentially streamlined into those three titles. The Tsar broke his promise, whereby essentially the Tsarevich was returned under the assumption that he'd be allowed to, you know, renounce the throne and essentially live quietly with his mistress and marry her, Afrosina, his Finnish mistress. And instead, he was subject to a torture regimen to expose so-called conspirators and traitors against Russia who were responsible for Alexei's flight. After months in which Alexei delivered a series of false confessions without corroborating evidence, the Tsarevich was flogged to death in the Peter and Paul fortress in Petersburg, after which the Senate condemned him to death posthumously as a traitor. The new succession law allowed the Tsar to designate his successor in the aftermath of Peter's death. Already suffering from ill health, Peter waded into the Finnish Gulf to rescue a group of drowning sailors in the winter of 1724, only exacerbating his already existing health problems. It was clear that by January of 1725 that the Tsar was dying. In terms of successors, there was his nine-year-old grandson, his daughter Anna, and his wife Catherine, who he had crowned empress the previous year. An apocryphal story claims that the Tsar scrawled a note, "Leave all too," before collapsing in exhaustion. And I mean apocryphal because it's just brilliantly absurd and poignant so as to be almost very unlikely. The death of Alexei and the ambiguity over the new succession rules left Russia in a situation reminiscent of the death of Ivan IV and would lead to a period of instability marking the rest of the 18th century, known as the era of palace revolutions. Now, I've continuously alluded to Ivan IV, and maybe it's something I will return to, which is a comparison between Ivan IV and Peter the Great, especially with reference to the Great Northern War and the Livonian Wars and the furnace of Russian imperial autocracy. But despite the fact that they were not really related, there were many similarities between them, other than the, you know, reforming zeal, the autocracy, the maritime influence, the fascination with foreigners. In the case of Ivan the Great, it was with England, in particular Elizabeth I. It should also be noted that they shared many similarities in terms of their temperament. Perhaps the main thing that divided them was that Peter the Great was more or less indifferent towards religion. He was personally pious, but he hated the administration, what he considered the corruption of the clergy, and was all too willing to impose some form of national church system, which looked more like Anglicanism than the traditional system of symphonia between the patriarch and the emperor, or the Byzantine model. But when we look at Peter the Great, I mean, he was renowned for having his violent tics, his violent temper, which is symptomatic of epilepsy, which is something which has also been attributed to Ivan the Terrible. Both Ivan the Terrible and Peter are also known for their essentially their need to be calmed down by some very, you know, strong women. In the case of Ivan the Terrible, it was Anastasia Romanova. In the case of Peter the Great, it was Catherine. Catherine was the only woman who could bring him down from his sort of unrepentant bouts of rage, where he would go on these very violent manic frenzies. So in many ways, they were similar. But nevertheless, the indirect result of the Petrine reforms was to issue in this period of palace revolutions, also known as the period of women in the Russian 18th century. Now, my historical demarcation here is a bit of a misnomer, because my time frame intentionally begins with a palace revolution. Indeed, the last major palace revolution in Russia was the deposition of Paul I in 1801. However, this period begins with a woman assuming the reins of power. Nevertheless, the reforms of Peter engendered the conditions for not one, but four women holding the title of Empress Regnant from 1725 to 1796, with two brief interruptions from Peter II and Peter III, both grandsons of Peter the Great. But all this can be surmised as an ongoing crisis of legitimacy in what will become the defunct House of Romanov, and the ambiguity over the succession and the political role of the palace guards regiments established by Peter the Great rather than that of the Streltsy. So, albeit even though the costumes have changed and the names have changed, all the elements essentially remain consistent from that great palace revolution of 1682, which brought the Regent Sophia into power. Towards the end of Peter's reign, Catherine and Alexander Menshikov were at the center of a web of corruption. Menshikov was notorious for his misuse and appropriation of state funds, all the more remarkable considering Peter's own view on corruption and his dependence on Menshikov. And of course, Peter had a very violent view towards corruption, and essentially at one point said he wanted to execute anyone who was accused of any impropriety whatsoever. And of course, conveniently, it was Menshikov who dissuaded the Tsar from that plan. Catherine herself, now Empress, had the support of the Mons family. Interestingly enough, this is via Anna Mons, the first foreign mistress of Peter the Great. And this is particularly Willem Mons, who was also rumoured, in another note of irony, to be Catherine's lover. Not only that, but Willem Mons was also selling access to the Tsar. When Peter discovered this, Willem Mons was executed, and his head was shown to Catherine the Great. And again, this is another bout of Peter's, you know, violence. But had it been Henry the Great, Catherine would have definitely been executed. Not only would have survived that, but would have gone on to succeed him. But nevertheless, this is essentially what ended their relationship as they were alive. The couple were essentially estranged from this point, the execution of William Mons. And why Catherine came to power was essentially the first of these palace coups organized by Menshikov and men surrounding Menshikov, who were the new men who had been brought up and essentially attained power throughout Peter the Great. They weren't part of the old Russian nobility. And of course, the guard regiments invariably went over to Catherine's side as well. While Catherine's ascension set a precedent for legal female rule, not to mention she was a commoner, and that had to be a state secret thereafter, real power was executed by a new body under Menshikov and Peter Tolstoy, the Supreme Privy Council of Six. Her brief reign was noted for reducing military expenditure, reducing the tax burden on the peasantry, while mainly focusing on augmenting the court culture of Petersburg. In addition to the Peterhof, there was now Catherine's patronage of Tsarskoye Selo, in what would later become the Catherine Palace. After Catherine's death, Peter II, the Tsar's grandson, Tsar Alexei, was proclaimed Tsar and immediately placed under the control of Menshikov, who raised him in his own palace. Menshikov's attitude towards the Tsar left little room for ambiguity. Menshikov intended to rule, even engaging his daughter to the Tsar. A short illness cost Menshikov's career, as his main competitor on the council, Baron Ostermann, and again, one of these German-born new men who had been brought in during the reign of Peter the Great, and the powerful and ancient Dolgorukov family assumed the control of the Tsar and exiled Menshikov to Siberia, where he died. As Peter entered adolescence, he demonstrated many of the worst aspects of Peter the Great's personality, while showing now very little interest in ruling. Instead, the Dolgorukov family attempted to sate his every desire, indulging the boy's alcoholism, and again, essentially became an alcoholic at the age of 13. I know someone's going to probably add a Russian insinuation there, but nevertheless, it was quite appalling at that time, especially given the neglect towards his education as well, as if they were all expecting him to die. And of course, he was engaged to someone he became very infatuated with, who just so happened to be a member of the Dolgorukov clan, Catherine. Corruption was endemic, and foreign observers wondered how the largest country in the world could function at all, yet at all maintain such an ostentatious court surrounding this delinquent Tsar. Through the influence of the Dolgorukovs, Tsar Peter II moved the capital back to Moscow, and when he fell ill with smallpox, through their influence, he attempted to make his fiancée his heir. It is difficult to say what the long-term implications would have been had the Dolgorukov scheme succeeded. Nevertheless, Peter's death ended the direct line of agnatic male Romanovs, leading the succession once again in doubt. Left with the issue of the succession, the Supreme Privy Council passed over Elizabeth Romanov, the legitimized daughter of Peter and Catherine, in favor of Anna, the second daughter of Ivan V, Peter the Great's half-brother. She was a widow living in Courland and modern-day Latvia. With no heir and no husband, the council deduced that they would be able to rule essentially unimpeded, using Anna as a figurehead. To guarantee this, the council gave Anna a list of conditions, which would have stripped her of most of her prerogatives, and given them to the council. The framers of the conditions were the Golitsyn and Dolgorukov families, who were quickly disempowered, while a new court faction advised Anna to assume autocratic rule and dispense with the conditions, which she duly did, ripping up the conditions. Prince Golitsyn was forced to become her court jester, and was forced to marry a Kalmyk peasant, while Anna ordered a palace made of ice constructed for the couple's wedding night, indicative of her extravagance, her puerility, and her cruelty. Anna moved the capital back to St. Petersburg. Thereafter, it more aptly represented a window on the west due to the influence of Germans in her court. The government was effectively run by Anna's paramour von Biron, or rather Biron, in what would be referred to as the Bilonovshchina. Under Biron, the role of Peter the Great's secret office of investigation, which essentially was the secret police, was resurrected and expanded, and was responsible for the torture and deaths of around 20,000 Russian nobles. Through the influence of the dominant German court faction, Western theatre and opera were adopted into Russian high society. The disproportionate influence of the Germans and von Biron are symptoms less perhaps of Russia's general westernization, but that of the court, and for the rest of Russia, domination by a foreign clique, which led to increasing Germanophobia, and Anna's reign becoming synonymous with arbitrariness, pettiness, and cruelty. As part of a conspiracy to disinherit the line of Peter the Great forever, in favour of her own line descended from Ivan V, her niece, through her sister Catherine, Anna Leopoldovna, was to marry Antony Ulrich of Brunswick and produce Russia's future Tsar, Ivan VI. Anna adopted the child and named von Biron as regent when she died in 1740. Ivan was less than a year old when he became Tsar. Ivan Leopoldovna was very quickly able to remove von Biron from power, though her own regency for the infant Tsar would last only 1 year before the next palace revolution. Elizabeth, the only surviving daughter of Peter the Great, had been waiting in the wings. The only distinction she had gained was briefly during Menshikov's domination of the Privy Council. Elizabeth had a particularly strong relationship with the Preobrazhensky regiment of her father and had proclaimed herself godmother to all their children. The incompetence of Ivan's regency regime left her with no end of sympathisers, both to domestic Russian nobles, clergymen, and the foreign courts of Sweden and France, who were concerned that the regency government was pursuing a pro-Austrian course. Upon declaring her intentions to the Preobrazhensky regiment of deposing the regency, they rallied to her side and carried out a bloodless coup, after which she made a vow to abstain from executions, in stark contrast to the Biron of Shivna. And one of these abstentions from executions was that of the young Tsar himself. She essentially credited the Tsar as being nothing but an honest bystander, and she therefore owed him no enmity. Nevertheless, he was locked up for the rest of his life and would ultimately end up in the Schlüsselburg fortress. Elizabeth presented herself as a Russian liberator from the German domination and exiled many of Anna's advisers, such as Ostermann. Intending to rule in the vein of Peter the Great, Elizabeth hoped to inculcate the same spirit of westernization in the broader population and intellectual circles of the empire by expanding the Petrine system of education beyond the service nobility to non-serfs. In continuing her father's aim, perhaps this is the most obvious in her patronage of the Russian Versailles in St. Petersburg, through employing the Italian Bartolomeo Rastrelli to refashion the Peterhof, literally just means the Peterstead, or sort of the Peterhouse, or the city, the Peter City, and construct the Catherine and Winter Palaces as well. And those are the main palaces you are going to see, essentially, if you ever visit St. Petersburg. Of course, much of the Winter Palace has now been converted into the Hermitage Museum. To complement her state-building program and to maintain the opulence of the Russian court, Elizabeth increased indirect taxes such as that of salt, while increasing the scale of Russia's primitive road network to facilitate imports. It is under Catherine the Great that the Russian court achieved its pedigree as one of the most lavish and decadent in Europe, rivaling Versailles and Vienna. Upon assuming the reins of government, Elizabeth quickly re-established the governmental forms created by Peter the Great and had lapsed under her immediate predecessors, while attempting to imitate Peter's ambition and foreign policy. After consolidating Russia's rule over the steppe in Siberia, she was able to compel the Swedes to cede to Russia key fortresses on the Finnish border to guarantee the security of St. Petersburg. Despite the original Finnish and Prussian hopes for Elizabeth's reign, she gravitated towards Austria under her foreign minister, Bestuchev. As head of a mercenary empire, Catherine placed the Russian army at the disposal of the Austrians toward the end of the Austrian War of Succession. The consequence of the Austrian alliance was that Russian influence over Poland increased significantly, while their own political situation deteriorated, isolating the only power that could threaten Russia's informal control. Poland increased while their own political situation deteriorated, while she was intent on politically isolating the only power that could threaten Russia's informal control over Poland, which was Prussia. To this end, Bestuchev, along with von Kaunitz of Austria and Madame de Pompadour of France, was able to effect a diplomatic revolution against Prussia in 1756. When hostilities started with Frederick's invasion of Saxony, she raised an army of 85,000 men to complement the Austrians by invading East Prussia. From 1758, Russia held the initiative in the war against Prussia, though Russia wasn't able to properly exploit their victory at Kunersdorf, after which Prussia led an increasingly desperate campaign for the next few years. Elizabeth never married and faced the same predicament as Anna over the selection of an appropriate heir. She designated Peter of Holstein-Gottorp, her nephew through Peter's daughter Anna, as her heir, quickly after her original coup. Peter was positioned dynastically to become King of Sweden, and the young prince was made to renounce that claim and convert from Protestantism to Orthodoxy. Sophia of Anhalt-Zerbst, a German prince and cousin of Peter from an unremarkable German state, was selected with the support of Frederick the Great and her own ambitious mother, Joanna. It formed a greater part of the Lubukina conspiracy. And this is, again, another link back to William and Anna Mons, orchestrated by Frederick the Great to undermine Bezuchev and the Russo-Austrian alliance. But the actual details of the conspiracy really are neither here nor there. The conspiracy failed, and Joanna, who was considered a Prussian partisan, was banned from entering Russia. Sophia, nevertheless, was safe and followed Peter, her husband, to Russia, converting to Orthodoxy, and she took the name Catherine. They did not consummate their marriage for about 8 years. And the problem, I think, in our entire understanding of Peter is that most of our understanding of Peter comes from Catherine and her disdain of him, which is often essentially a propagandistic tool, which was later used to justify and legitimate her, what is correctly her usurpation of her husband, Peter the Third. And this is what I mean by, you know, officially they did not consummate their marriage for 8 years. And I think for all intents and purposes, we can agree that Paul was the son of Peter, especially in terms of mannerisms, unless he was very keenly trying to imitate who he thought was his father. But nevertheless, Catherine would even claim that her son Paul was invariably a bastard to try and undermine any sort of attempt for him to essentially usurp her, or not really usurp her, but claim his rightful authority as Tsar. And again, this was the result of many of her affairs. And one of the things which Catherine the Great was very prolific at was sex. Catherine would claim that her husband suffered from corporal's mania, an obsession with uniforms, military discipline, and the parade, often playing with his toy soldiers. It should be noted that in this sense, Peter shared many qualities with his grandfather, Peter the Great, in addition to stubbornness and a violent temper, an uncouthness and lack of cultivation, which Catherine ascribed to puerility, if not imbecility. Perhaps this reforming mania in line with the great Peter is a better indication of Peter's capabilities rather than the obvious propagandistic view we have inherited from Catherine. Upon becoming emperor in 1762, Peter, a devotee of Frederick the Great, concluded a separate peace with Prussia and placed his army at the disposal of his idol in a total reversal of Elizabeth's foreign policy. With Prussia as ally to Peter, Peter then moved to consolidate his rule over Holstein and utilize his dynastic claims in the war against Denmark. While this is often used as evidence of his lack of Russian concern, with two quotes detailing his desire to be at once a Prussian general under Frederick the Great or King of Sweden over being Emperor of Russia. It is possible that had his plan succeeded, however, that Russian control over the Baltic would have been strengthened, and perhaps the Russian navy could have attained a port in the North Sea with access to the Atlantic Ocean. Domestically, Peter issued a law to every single day of his six-month reign, including reversing many of the decisions undertaken by Elizabeth, as it lacks the emperor's control over the Russian church. Peter increased it, while attempting to stymie Russian dependence on imports in favor of mercantilism and possibly autarky, essentially economic self-control in terms of like domination of internal resources. And possibly most significant was the reform to dress and discipline standards imposed on the guard regiments, which mimicked Prussia, while increasing the severity of punishments for minor infractions. And this is significant in the sense of the people who would constitute the coup against Peter the Third 6 months into his reign. And this is where we really get to Catherine the Great. After having given birth to Paul in the 1750s, it was unlikely that Catherine would have survived long as Empress Consort, given the couple's mutual disdain. For her own survival, let alone the attainment of power in Russia, she became the unofficial head of the opposition to her husband. Although educated in French and German and raised as a Lutheran, Catherine made a sincere attempt to learn Russian properly and commit to her education in Orthodoxy, in contrast to her husband, who never achieved a firm grasp of the language of Russian. Sex would be her greatest weapon in the cultivation of potential allies against her husband during the remainder of Elizabeth's reign. These would include Poniatowski and Grigory Orlov. Orlov was an officer in the St. Petersburg Cadets, and through cultivating alliances in the palace regiments, she was directly imitating the link established between Elizabeth and the Preobrazhensky regiment during her opposition to Anna. By the time of Elizabeth's death in 1762, both Tsar and Tsarina were well aware of the other's sexual affairs. Peter's reforms had the effect of alienating many of the nobility, clergy and army in short order, despite actually giving the nobility freer, more freedoms, and the fact that they were no longer obliged to do military service or civil service for 25 years. Upon the rumour that her husband was prepared to have her arrested, Catherine departed for the Semyonovsky guard barracks, where Catherine was recognised by various defecting elements of the clergy as empress in her own right. Peter was arrested and forced to sign a document abdicating his throne. Peter consented, with the understanding that he'd be allowed to return to Holstein. Instead, he was almost certainly murdered by Alexei Orlov, the brother of Grigory, at the Palace of Rosva, in contrast to Elizabeth, who had refused to murder Ivan VI, having him instead interned in Schlüsselburg Fortress. In 1764, upon the discovery of Ivan VI's identity by some guards, an escape plan was orchestrated, but the Tsar was murdered before he could be rescued. Technically, Catherine had no claim to the throne, other than acting as the regent of Paul I, a position which became ever more absurd due to her rule enduring well into his adulthood. She had no interest in being a mere regent, and was crowned a sole empress and would rule Russia for the next 34 years. But yes, interestingly, she had essentially given orders to the guards at Schlüsselburg. A few of them were privy to the identity of their prisoner as the Tsar Ivan VI, that were he to escape, he would be immediately executed. And of course, because of this legitimacy lack, essentially, the fact that she was put in due to a conspiracy of some foreign powers, the nobility and aspects of the clergy. Many of the rank and file soldiers, lower orders, peasantry, were very unhappy with an empress who was essentially German-born of the from Anhalt-Zerbst of the Ascania dynasty, no sort of royal link to the Romanovs. And unlike Catherine, who was, you know, a successful somewhat spouse to Peter the Great and had some form of legitimacy in attaining rule, Catherine the Great came to power by deposing and murdering her husband, who was the legitimate Tsar. So there was an escape 2 years after her her original usurpation to rescue Ivan VI, but immediately upon the escape, the guards of the Schlüsselburg carried out their orders and murdered the Tsar before he could become a rival. She did not, Catherine the Great, however, did not reverse Peter's Prussian alliance, although Catherine was interested in maintaining the balance of power in Europe, positioning herself as an honest broker, retaining flexible relations with both Prussia and Austria. Peter had begun his reign with a campaign against the Ottomans in Azov, albeit had been forced to cede Azov back to the Ottomans, leaving them masters of the Black Sea, in contrast to his success against Sweden in the Great Northern War. Through the influence of her new favourite and possible morganatic husband, Grigory Potemkin, Catherine oversaw the Russo-Turkish War of 1768 to 1774, one of the Ottomans' most decisive defeats. In that war, Russia gained control over the northern coast of the Black Sea, while the Russians established new cities such as Odessa, Kherson, and Ekaterinoslav, which just literally means Catherine's glory, in what was to become the new governorate of Novorossiya, New Russia. Crimea became independent of the Ottomans in 1770, before being annexed to Russia in 1783. Hostilities with the Ottomans were renewed shortly after, and this time Catherine was far more ambitious, with plans to partition the Ottoman Empire of Joseph II of Austria as part of the Greek plan, whereby the her second grandson, Constantine, who was named expressly for this purpose, would have become the Byzantine emperor of essentially, you know, a restored Byzantine Empire. In the event the war was not as triumphant as expected, and Russia gained territories instead, which expanded the empire to the Dniester River, again near Moldova, the Moldovan border. While the Ottomans defeated, Catherine turned her attention to the Caucasus, then under Persian suzerainty. Suzerainty essentially means that when you have informal sort of control as part of a sphere of influence. The Persians were present in Armenia, they were present in Azerbaijan, and so they had a minor presence in what we'd now call the Derbent region in the far southeast extreme of modern-day Russia. But essentially, this was all under Persian control. And after attacking and defeating the Turks, she turned towards the Persians and was able to make Georgia a Russian protectorate, while Count Valerian Zubov led a punitive expedition into Persia, taking Derbent, conquering much of Azerbaijan, and would have moved in to potentially take Tehran and place a Russian puppet on the throne of Iran, were it not for Paul, upon becoming Tsar, immediately recalling Zubov and earning his lasting enmity, which would contribute to his death and murder in 1801. Perhaps Catherine's greatest legacy was in Poland. For centuries, Poland had served as Russia's chief antagonist, and by the 1760s, it had become a Russian supplicant. Whereas the Great Northern War had been a Russian victory, Poland, which had entered that war assuming the position of a senior ally, was devastated economically and remained afterwards politically divided. The Saxon hold over Poland was broken in 1763, and Catherine suggested that Poniatowski, her lover, become king of Poland. Perhaps the last serious attempt to secure Polish independence was the War of the Bar Confederation, which assumed both a Polish nationalist and international Catholic spirit against the Russians and their puppet, international Catholic in the sense that it was supported tentatively by both the Austrians and the French for the purpose of maintaining a major Catholic power in the East, which would act as a break on the Calvinist-Lutheran influence of Prussia and the Orthodox influence of Russia. Nevertheless, this was all for naught. Despite French support, the Russians defeated the coalition of the Polish-Lithuanian magnates and their volunteer supporters, and Catherine was reluctantly persuaded of the necessity of partition by Frederick the Great of Prussia, who had his own designs on Poland. That and Austria was given territory in Catherine's role as international mediator to compensate Austria for Russia's decisive victory against the Ottomans that may have upset the balance of power in Europe. A permanent council was established in Poland to make the Polish rural government nominally more efficient, when in reality it was a body under the authority of the Russian ambassador and de facto proconsul over Poland, leaving the council to be dubbed the permanent betrayed. The Polish Patriotic Party, who opposed the council, took power in 1789 and established the Great Parliament, which ushered in the Constitution of the 3rd of May 1791, establishing the principles of a sovereign constitutional monarchy and ending the period of magnate domination known as the Golden Liberty, which had been in existence since the middle of the 16th century. Catherine was able to exploit noble dissatisfaction with the constitution to establish the Tarkowice Confederation, which invited Catherine to intervene in the Commonwealth. After a brief war, Poland and Lithuania was partitioned between Prussia and Russia again in 1793, and after another uprising, all three powers, including Austria, definitively partitioned Poland and Lithuania in 1795, after which Poland, Lithuania ceased to exist. And you can see on this map the first partitions, albeit we have the Napoleonic War, the brief restoration of the Duchy of Warsaw, and then the reincorporation of those territories mostly into Russia as Congress Poland. So Russia ultimately would actually gain more territories from this system of partitions. Now onto a question of the legacy of the partitions, and not with reference to Polish history, but with reference to Russian history and how beneficial they were to Russia. This is not as straightforward as it would necessarily seem. It was more complex in my view, because now Russia was directly responsible for a large number of Catholic Greeks, Greek Catholics, uniate, Catholic and Jewish former subjects of the Commonwealth. Russia had, at the beginning of Catherine's reign, been seen as the hegemon of all of Poland and Lithuania, and yet was now forced to cede the richest, most populous parts of the state to her rivals, Prussia and Austria. Moreover, even without a Polish state under a Russian vassalage, state of Russian vassalage, a large Polish-Lithuanian commonwealth served as a strategic buffer between all the great states. If I were to be uncharitable, I would argue that Catherine was the dupe of Prussia, unintentionally fulfilling the original aspirations that Frederick the Great had set for Sophia of Anhalt-Zerbst when he advocated making her Tsarina of Russia all the way back during the War of Austrian Succession in 1741. That's just a point to make. Again, you can say in contrast to that, in furtherance of some sort of a Slavophile or pan-Slavist agenda, despite the fact that many of the people who are now Russian subjects, no longer Polish-Lithuanian subjects, were Catholics, Greek Catholics and Jews, a large number of them were also Eastern Slavs. So we almost have here the unification of all of Eastern Slavdom which had been disunified after the Mongol invasion, with one key exception, which is that Galicia Lodomeria, which the eastern part of it had a large Ruthenian population, would only become part of the Russian Empire as an occupied province in the First World War. So there is the sort of pan-Slavic aspect of nationalism. But again, that was very much a post hoc justification, something which arose during the 19th century. Whereas here, Catherine the Great was expanding essentially as part of great power considerations of balance between Prussia and Austria, rather than any preordained ethnic or vested interests. And as a result of that, and in comparison to what Russia actually had, it may seem on this map on the left that Russia gained the bulk of the territory, but these were invariably the poorer, less well-developed, less populous territories. You know, interestingly enough, probably the wealthiest part of the empire, this area of Livonia, which is now Estonia and Latvia, was probably as wealthy as this entire region, which had just been annexed, because this region had been dominated by the Baltic Germans and had a advanced Swedish administration when it was taken over. But Polish Lithuania was essentially in a constant state of collapse until they desperately tried to arrest the situation with the 1791 constitution, which ultimately failed to create a sovereign Poland. So now turning to Catherine's domestic record, Peter the Great has started the process of building state manufactories and importing foreign, invariably German, talent. At the start of her reign, Catherine supported the migration of Germans into the Volga region to increase wheat production in what was essentially the breadbasket of Europe. It is also during her reign that Russia introduced its first paper ruble alongside silver. Nevertheless, Russia was still a society of nobles, peasants, and serfs, and only a fledgling mercantile class existed, often stifled by overregulation, as Catherine aimed to micromanage all aspects of the economy, finance, and government with her comprehensive, enlightened, all-encompassing systems. And I do say that with a hint of sarcasm. What industries existed in Russia pertained to Russia's mining operations in the Urals and fledgling textile industries in Moscow. Catherine styled herself as an enlightened despot on the model of Frederick the Great, and yet her reign, at once the center of the so-called Russian Enlightenment, represents the beginning of an intellectual, political, and metaphysical schism concerning what is Russia. Presaging the 19th century Russian reaction against the Western and against the West, and the notion of modernity in the Western vein. Catherine was less an innovator in this period as the patron of the nation's scientists, poets, institutions of higher learning, but essentially she was following in part of Russia's standard trajectory, which had been set for the entirety of Russia's long 18th century, which I'm dubbing from the reign of Theodore III or possibly Peter the Great in 1682. Though she was doubtless possessed of a greater academic acuity than her predecessors, including Peter the Great. She was engaged in correspondence with the French philosophers, mainly Voltaire, engaging with them in French, and it is Voltaire who conferred on her the epithet of the Great. When we talk about Westernization, I can't help but consider it a class phenomenon pertaining to the Russian gentry and the circles around the empress. The upper classes were instructed in natural sciences, Western languages, the state schools emphasized, and by state schools, I mean schools which were funded for the nobility, not for the masses, emphasized a Western orientation and service to the state as secular citizens. This was a point of virtue, and again, Catherine meant virtue, that contrasted with those of inferior social rank. Perhaps the best example of this is the Smolny Institute for Young Ladies, based on the French Maison Royale de Saint-Louis. To emphasize that Catherine meant a secular iteration for virtue, she was roughly indifferent to the church beyond using its resources to fund her wars, often driving monks and clergymen into poverty. All believers were viciously targeted by Catherine and deported to Siberia before she relented under the guise of some enlightened, inspired religious toleration. By 1786, Catherine had excluded theology from her system of lay education for the nobility. Conversely, this distinction between westernized and those possessed of virtue in the way Catherine would have understood it comes crashing down considering the great enlightened enterprise of the 18th century, that of the abolition of serfdom. Beginning a process of reform in that vein, Catherine came quickly to understand that autocracy, Russian autocracy, had a cost. The continued service and acceptance by the nobility, who were not prepared to give up their few remaining privileges. Indeed, Catherine augmented their rights, refusing petitions from the serfs over the nobility, who instead dealt directly with the serf problem in their own estates. Catherine herself and the imperial state owned millions of serfs, who Catherine would routinely give as rewards to political favourites, lovers, and her various bastard children. The greatest instance of this was the Charter of the Gentry in 1785, which exempted the nobility from tax, corporal punishment, and Catherine confirmed their rights over serfs, confirmed their rights to self-organisation, akin to dumas, and their own essentially seigneurial courts or noble courts. Moreover, the nobility had been free from compulsory military or state service. Again, she was following in a pattern which had been determined by Peter III, so as not to completely eliminate his influence. I do actually believe that his influence on Catherine is actually quite stark, and you can actually say that Catherine the Great was following in the vein of her husband, not in contrast to him as some sort of eccentric lunatic, as he's often been depicted. Catherine had effectively reversed many of Peter the Great's reforms, namely that of the spirit of the Table of Ranks. The best instance of Catherine's readiness to accept genealogy and documents for confirmation of nobility over the idea of slusba, or service. One of the first things that happened when the Manichesboll was abolished is not just that the Manichesboll was abolished. The Manichesboll was a whole system of genealogies to establish rank, and there was a purpose, therefore, in destroying it, indicating clearly that such things didn't matter anymore. And yet Catherine was now prepared to re-establish a form of pseudo-Manichesboll over this idea of slusba, which had been established by Peter the Great. Catherine's legitimacy had always been weak among the peasantry and the serfs, who were likely to brand an illegitimate ruler as the Antichrist. Catherine's failure to ameliorate their condition, combined with a series of major epidemics throughout the 1770s, noble mismanagement contributed to the Pugachev Rising of 1773 to 1774. Pugachev claimed to be Peter III and styled himself as a humble orthodox advocate for the common man and the rights of the Cossacks, in contrast to the wicked Catherine and her corrupt, often foreign advisers. If anything, the scale and the nature and the early success of the Pugachev Rising, which was reminiscent of that of the false Dimitris during the Time of Troubles, the Stankarazin during the reign of Alexis, is symbolic of the clash of two very different Russias and how localized Russia's westernization was. The rebellion was crushed and Pugachev was beheaded. The Cossacks who had joined the rebellion saw their rights reduced further, while Catherine erected more military garrisons in various trouble spots on the border. Catherine's immediate response per her constitution or nakaz, essentially a great edict of laws or institutions, was to speed up the reform of the imperial administration, creating 50 provinces and 500 districts. Prior to Catherine, the state bureaucracy of Russia had been small compared to European standards, despite Russian autocracy. And the reign of Catherine saw a substantial increase in the number of local and provincial bureaucrats. Nevertheless, her own reforming zeal was checked with the execution of Louis XVI, her erstwhile rival in 1793. Toward the end of her life, Russia's raison d'etre was confused, and her indifferent stance on the clergy was reversed. Her final years were marked by turmoil over the succession pertaining to the vengeful son Paul. The vengeful son Paul, who was essentially cast in Russia as the Russian Hamlet, was essentially disinherited during this long played out succession conflict called the Battle of the Palaces, the last, you know, in a series of, well, not even the penultimate and the last of the series of palace revolutions. And when Paul did take over, he very much imitated the style and the military obsessiveness or the corporal mania, which Catherine referred to, of his father, Peter III. And unfortunately, like Peter III, he was also assassinated due to a conspiracy of the nobility. And who Catherine had originally hoped to become Tsar, her grandson, Alexander, again, consciously chose the name Alexander to inspire, you know, such great feats such as that of Alexander the Great. If anything, I think Alexander the Great, which we'll get on to later in a future lecture, best sort of exemplifies this torn state of Russian affairs, you know, at the one side tugging towards the enlightened so-called, you know, West liberalism, and on the other tugging towards a more parochial understanding of Russian identity, nationhood, and orthodoxy. And he undergoes a major religious conversion as part of, mainly as a result of, the burning of Moscow in 1812. You can say a definitive moment symbolically in Russia's change of national destiny. But nonetheless, essentially, that is the effect Russian westernization is that it was very localized. And as we see with the Pugachev uprising, all these elements that we've been talking about, the peasant conceptions of legitimacy, royalty, and again, this justified rebellion against a, you know, a religious and a political usurper who is always cast in, you know, Russia, you have the Tsar, who is not indicative of someone representing Christ or under Christ, but who is almost seen as literally Christ. And then in the opposition, you have the Antichrist. In that sense, that is what Catherine represented to many of the serfs who suffered under the yoke of a much empowered nobility, which she had consciously allied to throughout the majority of her reign. So when we're talking about the overall effects of sort of the Russian system, Russia has now entered into, for what it's worth, the system of great power. What it is to be a great power essentially is to be recognized as such, as recognized to having your own sphere of influence and being part of the international system of great power politics within Europe. And it is in this case that Russia has been set up for the Napoleonic Wars, the Wars of the French Revolution. And of course, the French Revolution takes place in 1709. Catherine is going to die in 1796, and Napoleon is going to come to power in 1799. So all of these things we will talk about next time. And of course, this will lead quite nicely on to next week, when we will be discussing what is going to happen over in the Ottoman Empire. And I'll be examining more of these aspects of the Greeks prepared to rise up, and this idea of the Greek plan, or the resurrected notion of the Byzantine Empire. But essentially, that is the end of the lecture. If you have any questions, do ask so now. And I will just quickly look over the super chats and answer them to the best of my ability. Right. Mr. Montefontaine for £20. Thank you very much. Thank you in advance for the stream. Well, thank you very much. Are there any good fictionalized history books? I struggle to retain information from non-fiction when reading, but I'm fascinated by history. Many thanks. Well, unfortunately, Mr. Montefontaine, I'm really not the best person to ask, because I really don't read any fiction. I mean, people are going to shout at me because I have done a Tolkien series. But again, that's not really historical fiction. I mean, I'm very boring. I don't read for pleasure, unfortunately. I just read non-fiction books, again, professionally, copiously. And I have very little sort of passion or desire to just read for fun, unfortunately. I think that's the consequence of just perpetually reading. In my case, you just want to get away from it. I think someone asked me a similar question when I was doing my Anatomy of Austria-Hungary. And it was very much the same case, where they were asking, how do you not know or have read these books on Franz Josef or anything? But no, I don't. I'm afraid I'm terrible when it comes to literature. The English Loyalist for $9.99. Thank you very much. Are you pro-Putin since you're talking about Russia? Jokes. Thank you for the vid. This is my favorite part of Russian history. So much happens, especially the Great Northern War of Charles. Indeed. A lot does happen. I'm not going to answer that question because, as far as I'm aware, the UK government will sanction me regardless of what I say. But nevertheless, it is a fascinating part of Russian history. I hope I've done a decent enough job of it in terms of summarizing it for you. So thank you very much, English Loyalist. Konstock for, I don't know what currency that is, I'm afraid. I remember a discussion of the whole crew about the greater role of women in Russia, maybe a Byzantine influence. Is it real? Well, yes. If you go back and you watch, what is it? What lecture was it? It was, I think it was Russian Autocracy, where I was talking about Tsar Ivan III and Tsar Ivan IV. I talked about the influence of Byzantinism and Telim, and the conscious imitation of many Byzantine influences and customs. So if you want to learn more about that, do check out that episode. But in terms of how it pertains to this period, it pertains really right up until the reign of Peter the Great, who has absolutely no interest in Byzantine rituals. Again, it's different to see how sincere, devout, etc., his modification of Russia is. I'm inclined to see it in many senses as cosmetic. You know, when I, for example, I see him abolishing the patriarchate, I almost feel that it's some sort of confused notion of looking at a model of religious efficiency. Say, for example, looking at the clergy in England and saying, I believe the clergy in England, I don't know, at the time, to be better educated and, I don't know, more less corrupt than the clergy of Russia at that time. Again, I'm not necessarily informed enough on that subject to make that point conclusively. But from a rather sort of simplistic mindset, where you're not looking at things in terms of the greater symbolism, but you are looking at things in terms of corruption, you are looking at things in terms of pragmatic institutions, efficiency, etc. You see that, you come back and you want to impose a system which is equivalent to that of, say, for example, having a holy synod under the Tsar as the supreme governor of the religion, akin more to Anglicanism. And you wed that into the system of religious administration. But of course, there was already a domestic religious backing from the Kiev school to try and substantiate the Orthodox argument for that. But again, it's one of these amazing false starts, isn't it? That Russia starts off assuming this idea of the mantle of the Third Rome. Macarius tries, you know, to use the elevation of the Tsar, Ivan IV, as part of this greater sort of movement to independence of the Church, who have established the office of the Patriarchate. Then conversely, as part of this ongoing effort for the Patriarchate to gain independence from the Tsar, Nikon leads a charge of reform, which is aimed on the surface at purifying the various religious mantras of the, you know, the deviations, so to speak, of Russian old believers to a more purified Orthodox sect in line with Greek Orthodoxy. But nevertheless, this is also part of an ongoing struggle of religious control between the Patriarchate and the Tsar. And in the end, Peter the Great simply resolved this crisis, simply rejects the idea of symphonia, or the, you know, subtle distinction between supreme spiritual authority wielded by the patriarch or supreme secular authority wielded by the Tsar, and concludes it decisively on the side of the Tsar, saying the Tsar is the supreme spiritual and secular authority. There is no discussion. I will appoint the procurator of the Holy Synod, and I will appoint lay officials who are in line with my interests. And that is the system which the Russian Empire would establish up until the Russian Revolution, and Russia has only had a patriarch since the fall of the Tsars. Sonia Braut for $7 Canadian, thank you very much. Coffee, tea appreciation donation from Montreal, Canada. Well, thank you very much, Sonia Braut. It means so much. James for £5. Do you have a preferred traditionalist form of monarchy? The Spartan Jewel Kings is one of my favorites. Much appreciation from Devon. Keep it up. Well, thank you very much, James. In terms of my ideal preferred traditionalist monarchy, I mean, it's very difficult for me to say ideal, because that's, I rarely sort of think in terms of pure abstraction. I'm always thinking in terms of concrete historical examples. And in terms of, you know, looking at the Spartan conception, you can even more say it was rather a constitutional conception of kingship. And you can say that the Roman consulate bears closer sort of resemblance to the Spartan model of kingship than any sort of subsequent or, you know, notion of kingship from what we're talking about at the moment here. I guess my preferred notion, in absence, you know, of any sort of hardline, you know, historical analogy to draw to, is that I believe states should be small enough where you can actually sort of know who, you know, your local lord or official or governor is, you can contact him, and that there should be some form of direct redress to someone above him who is actually has immediacy or direct contact with the individual. I believe one of the tragedies and horrors of modern political systems is the fact that it's not obvious who is in charge. And even with that lack of you know, clear distinction of who is in charge and who isn't, there is a complete disconnect between the ruler and the rule. And I think this idea of personal connection between the ruler and the rule, the right of petition in particular, and again, this is something that Catherine the Great utilizes that as part of the reforms of absolutism in the 17th century and the 18th century, the ruler becomes more remote because the ruler has to personify an ideal of perfection, relying on the system of absolutism. What is lost in such a system is that the monarch becomes more of an idea, more remote, and becomes more a concept or an abstract, essentially. And so that idea of the personal connection, the personal link between the ruler and the rule, is lost. And I think that is tragic. And I think, interestingly enough, that is what it acts as an indicator for the creation of a modern political system. The modern political system, in contrast to the sort of system I'm talking about, is something which lacks any sort of personal relationship, where people become functionaries, voiceless parts of an institution. The institution speaks, but there is no sort of voice acting from that institution. And if there was, there was no way of contacting that person. So yes, that's just my brief summary in terms of my preferred traditionalist monarchy. I mean, in terms of like a literal tradition you can draw on, I'm obviously a Jacobite sympathizer, and you can look to Carlism, French legitimism, other sort of movements like that. I'd like to say I'm a real royalist, an ultra royalist, compared to whatever substitute there is for actually supporting our ridiculous monarchy now. Pelinor Whitestrake, 4899, thank you very much. I read that Peter inadvertently killed his niece's husband, the Duke of Courland, by demanding he drink a liter and a half of vodka every day. Is there any greater hellraiser in history? That wouldn't surprise me. Peter the Great was a notorious drinker, which is, obviously indicated with also Peter the Second as well. One of these sort of factors of the great embassy roaring throughout Europe is just this wave of almost like pillaging barbarians masquerading as the diplomatic aides of the Russians are when they ever come to your court. So no, that wouldn't surprise me at all. If Peter the Great did inadvertently kill off his the husband of the Empress Anna, who would later, of course, rule Russia during a particularly bizarre stage of its history. Lady of Shalott for £4.49. Catherine was realistic about the limits of autocracy, stating one must do things in such a way that they themselves want it done. I think that's one way of looking at the limits of autocracy. I mean, whenever she's in her correspondence with Voltaire, she's always indicating that reform has to be piecemeal, it has to be slow, that has to develop in what is seen as a way that is natural. Nevertheless, there were sort of elements that when that failed, Catherine the Great always relied on force ultimately to put rebellions down. And that is certainly the case with her reaction to Pugachev and her complete sort of lack of any sort of sympathy or understanding of what, Pugachev really represented, which is why I think Catherine the Great, represents that great gulf between the westernized sort of court, the idea of secular Western virtue based on enlightened values, whatever they are, compared to the old Russia, which is in many ways a constant feature since the time of Ivan the Great, Ivan the Terrible. So, and also I think in terms of, again, the realistic sort of implication of autocracy, I think that also underpins her rejection of the great sort of Enlightenment aim, which is the abolition of serfdom, and why she understood and relied more on her aristocracy, and again why she almost decided to make a cult out of the Russian aristocracy, believing that they were almost on a civilizing mission to represent an embodiment of virtue, which would be a model imitated by those of inferior social rank, as ridiculous as that sounds. But nevertheless, I think in that sense, Catherine was actually a pure elitist, in the sense of the way she sort of tried to cultivate her idea of an enlightened autocracy. But in terms of, what are the sort of broader implications of that? Like I say, I never believe that Catherine the Great, in contrast to someone like Elizabeth, or even in contrast to someone like the first Catherine, was ever popular among the ordinary people. She was certainly popular among the higher orders. I mean, when she held, she tried to essentially organize an assembly equivalent Duma or the mercantile classes, where they would have a assembly and equivalent rights, which he had given to the Duma, essentially the boyars of the Duma, even though it wasn't called that, it was called something else. And she was frustrated because rather than fulfilling their role, the thing they were petitioning over essentially was demanding of her that they be given the right to own serfs. Everyone wanted to enter into the Russian system of elites so that they could have the right to own serfs. And so serf control, serf allocation was a crucial part of her her style of governance, which was, a far departure from what you could say were any noble aims in which she originally started out as Russian ruler. But in terms of whether the people or anyone sort of knew this or wanted this, I don't tend to agree with Catherine. Votan 005 just sends $10 without a message. So thank you very much, Votan 005. That's very kind of you. Thank you. I'll just look over to see if there are any more questions which aren't super chats before I go. I'll probably stay for another 5 minutes if there are. Oh, yes, there's something I need to mention. I am doing a Ukraine stream on Sunday. It is essentially a stream. I've already covered Ukrainian history indirectly on the Orthodoxy, Autocracy and Nationality series. But I decided that now was an interesting time because I've heard some rather weird and silly arguments coming out about Ukrainian history. So I thought I would try and do my best stab at the topic and try and convey some form of understandable narrative about Ukrainian history from the origin of the term the Ukraine up until 1992. So someone is saying I'm feeling quite brave. I'm not feeling that brave. I'm only going to talk about how the Ukraine, i.e. the notion of a region or the notion of a borderland, became Ukraine, i.e. it became some form of nation state. That's one thing I'm going to try and talk about. I mean, I'm not going to bring this in and do a brief history of Ukraine from 1991 until 2022. I'm not going to be that brave. Right. Bolero 393 AM, keep doing God's work. Thank you for the stream. I'm not sure whether it is God's work, but nevertheless, Bolero 393, thank you very much. That is very kind of you. Right, there haven't been any questions, so we'll end this slightly early, I think, for this evening. So yes, what is there more to say? So yeah, I've mentioned the Ukraine stream on Sunday. Hopefully I survived that and I didn't have some form of fatwa put on me after that. I don't see why. I'm just going to be as objective as I can be. I do mean that earnestly. I always try and be as objective as I can be. I never reach a conclusion which I don't believe is completely substantiated by the facts, or at least you'll say the facts I've selected. But nevertheless, I will try and present a clearer view as possible. Now, tomorrow, I have the next episode of Adaranye, the Lord of the Rings series with Mr. Patriarch. He's been going through quite a rough time, unfortunately, at the moment. So we are going to be doing a shorter episode, which is also quite convenient. This is also the reason why I'm hosting this on Friday and this on Saturday rather than the other way around, which is how things normally should go. So on Saturday, I'll be hosting a shorter episode, which will be covering the Wars of Beleriand. So we'll be discussing the death of Fëanor and the siege of Angband by the elves against Morgoth. Interestingly enough, there isn't actually that much written in terms of like scholarly articles or anything on that topic. So it'll just be a short, cozy stream for about an hour and a half, about the same length as this one, albeit I'll be discussing with someone. I won't be just screaming to the void, talking about Russian history. Yes, the discussion for this will be on Monday. Next week, we will be discussing the Turkish history of the 18th century. Other than that, thank you all very much for listening. Thank you to everyone who sent a super chat. Thank you so much, and good night.